Edgar Bronfman was CEO of the Seagram Company for nearly 25 years and is one of the world's leading philanthropists. For more than two decades, he presided over the World Jewish Congress, where he helped expose Kurt Waldheim's Nazi past and got Swiss banks to own up to their role in World War II and its aftermath, all of which led to his being awarded a Presidential Medal of Honor, of Freedom. He's here now to talk about his latest book called Hope Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance, written with the help of Beth Zasloff. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm delighted that it has brought Edgar Bronfman to our studio today. Hello.
Hi.
What do you mean by a Jewish Renaissance? Is Judaism in need of a rebirth?
I'm afraid it is. The ancestors of the Jews that are here now, when they came to America, they didn't come here to be better Jews. They came here to have a better life. They just assumed that their children would be Jewish because the others would let them not be Jewish. And the most amazing thing happened. They all managed to get pretty close to assimilation. In fact, today there's a tremendous amount of assimilation going on.
Well, is this based on anecdotal evidence or have studies been conducted?
Very, very specific studies have been conducted. I got involved in this work when there was the demographic study done in 1990. I read it in 1993. I was a little late, but I realized how many Jews were intermarrying, and it was close to 50%. And I thought that you were quietly disappearing, so we ought to do something about it.
In fact, there were, I remember, ads that were being run in the New York Times and other publications saying, if this continues, will it mean the end of Judaism?
Well, yeah. And so far, it has not. But that doesn't mean that there hasn't been a great diminution of our numbers. But I think more important than that, and the reason of the need for the Renaissance, is that I always say our two biggest enemies are apathy and ignorance. I don't care and I don't know. And they don't know anything about Judaism. I mean, the average kid, the Jewish kid that goes to campus, he'll get a B or an A on almost any subject, but he'll flunk Judaism. He knows nothing about it. And I think that's where we need a renaissance. We have to do something about that.
Well, you say that Jews should shed their fears of anti-Semitism and focus more on celebrating Judaism's joy and culture. According to the Anti-Defamation League, about 15% of Americans, about 35 million people, are still anti-Semitic. And I just read in the newspaper last week that anti-Semitism is rising in Europe. In fact, the Pew Research Center issued the results of a survey that finds both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have risen in Europe over the last 4 years. The increase in anti-Jewish feeling was strongest in Spain, where 3 years ago, 21% of the respondents said that they had unfavorable opinions of Jews. That's risen to 46%, nearly half of all people in Spain, just below the 52% of Spaniards who said that they have negative views of Muslims.
Well, that's obviously a big problem. It's a bigger problem for organizations like the World Jewish Congress or for the people who live in Spain. But, you know, Spain has its own particular history when they threw the Jews out in 1492. And some are still apologetic that they did that because it might have held Spain back. But the anti-Semitism in the United States really isn't – 15% is a very high number. I judge it this way, that when Gore didn't lose, but when he lost the election in 2000, and he had a vice presidential candidate named Joe Lieberman, I didn't hear anybody say the reason they lost was because of the anti-Semitism. Nobody said that, and I never heard of it, you know. And I have pretty good ears out there to this subject, but so it's not that kind of anti-Semitism.
In fact, some people are saying anti-Semitism has changed from the old anti-Semitism of your father's generation. Now it really is linked much more with people who are having problems with Israel and what's going on in the Middle East.
I think that's true, and I think that, you know, liberal America is aghast sometimes at what they call the mistreatment of Palestinians without understanding the entire story. But still, there it is. And we noticed this when Rabin and Arafat shook hands, the amount of anti-Semitism plummeted worldwide. So it's obviously much more akin to that than it is to the personalities here.
You say that your father's generation stuck together out of necessity for protection in a world where anti-Semitism was a fact of life, whereas today Jews have more freedom and acceptance. But from what you said before, I get the feeling that you're also wondering whether that all that choice has diluted the Jewish community.
Well, I think there's no question it has. This is the first generation that being Jewish is a choice, not a condition.
But why is that bad? I mean, if people see it that way, then religious people who want to be religious will remain religious, and people who don't want to won't.
Well, I don't think it's a question of being religious. I think it's a question of a peoplehood, and I think it's denying your roots. And I have no listen to people to make a conscious choice, knowing something about Judaism and saying I'd rather not. Fine, I have no problem with that. What I have a problem with is the fact that there's such ignorance that they don't realize what a wonderful religion and what a wonderful condition Jewish living is.
But you have made it one of your goals to bring more young people to Jewish institutions like synagogues and community centers.
And Hillels.
The Hillels in colleges.
Yes, and that's perfectly true. I wouldn't put the accent on synagogues so much as I would put it on community centers and Jewish life.
So you really want to stress Jewish culture, a sense of the culture that is part that comes out of the religion but isn't necessarily involved with reciting prayers.
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. One of the nice things about Judaism is that our Talmud, which is basically our guide to living, tells us to ask questions. When you ask questions, you obviously doubt. When you doubt, you can be more honest than you have to affirm everything that you're supposed to believe. And therefore, if people are allowed to doubt, that means that you're not sure whether there's a God, there isn't a God. It's fine to leave it open like that. So but the important parts of Judaism is not the praying, even though praying for those who want to is wonderful. But the most important thing is just our heritage, our ethics, and our morals.
A friend of mine once said that, at least by his thinking, if you put a Jewish atheist, a Baptist atheist, and a Catholic atheist in the same room, the only thing that they would have in common is that they don't believe in God anymore. Because they have all been so affected by the culture that they grew up in.
That's true. I think that's true.
My guest is Edgar M. Bronfman, who has written with Beth Zaslav, Hope Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the intermarriage, and you've proposed increased outreach to intermarried couples, regardless of whether the non-Jewish spouse converts. That remains an unpopular idea in a lot of circles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not just among the Orthodox.
Well, no, there's certainly a lot in the conservatives. I'm not so sure about the reform, but there's certainly a lot of people that think that the non-Jewish spouse at least ought to convert before being allowed into the tent. I'm much more of a believer of Hillel, who said, when asked to explain the Bible standing on one foot, don't do anything else to anybody else that's abominable to you.
The golden rule.
But then he said, the rest is commentary, now go study.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, come in first and then study and learn something about it. And I think what he meant was you don't have to convert to enter the tent, but you should study once you're in the tent.
Don't some studies show that children of mixed marriages, even if they're raised to be Jewish, tend to marry outside the faith more often than children whose parents were both Jewish?
Well, you know, those statistics I'm very leery of, and I'll tell you why. You give me a group, a synagogue or a community, that's really welcoming to the non-Jewish spouse, and then I'll think about taking those figures seriously. But when a wife of a Jew goes to synagogue and nobody talks to her, it doesn't take her very long to say, to hell with this.
Well, some people contend that the only Jews who'll survive ultimately are the ultra-Orthodox, those who live what amounts to self-imposed, in a self-imposed Jewish ghetto. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly wouldn't do for me or for my children or for anybody I know.
Well, is this something that you came back to? You grew up. Did you grow up with a strong sense of your religion?
Well, I went to a non-Jewish school. It was in Canada, we had church schools, so it was either Protestant or Catholic. I went to a Protestant school. I knew I was Jewish, but, yeah, because we had Jewish holidays, which we went to, but I was kind of confused as to who I really was, because I was going to a non-Jewish school, and there weren't very many Jews in the school. Then when I went away to prep school in Canada, I was the first Jew to ever go there. So clearly I didn't have a tremendous sense of my Jewishness, nor did my parents.
And you describe your early experience with Judaism as joyless.
Mm. The Holocaust was going on. It wasn't very easy to be joyful about Judaism when Jews were being killed in Germany by the Holocaust.
So did you attend services in a synagogue? Did you celebrate the high holidays?
Oh, yes.
Passover?
As a child, I had to do all those things. But I kind of left the synagogue. Not kind of left. I left the synagogue when I was about, I don't know, 18. And I watched my father reading the service with the speed of summer lightning. And I said, "Did you know what you're saying?" He said, "I was taught to read." I said, "You mean you don't know what you're reading?" He said, "Well, no." I said, "Goodbye." I mean, to me, that wasn't praying any more than what I was doing was praying. And I still think that, you know, if that's all I can do is read the service, don't know what they're saying, then that's not prayer.
Haven't you been married a number of times?
Yeah.
Were all of your wives Jewish?
My first and my last were Jewish, and my middle one converted.
So what led you to, with this kind of background, to then feel it was important to come back to the religion?
Well, actually, it happened by happenstance. I was in Moscow. I spent a lot of time in Moscow getting the Jews out of the Soviet Union. And one day it happened to be Simchas Torah, which is the end of the reading of the Bible, a very joyous day. And we went by the Choral Synagogue, and I noticed there were absolutely thousands of people outside just milling around, obviously Jewish, and obviously talking to each other. And it occurred to me that maybe I'd been missing something about Judaism, because after all, religion had been banned in the Soviet Union for 70-odd years, and still people were banding together and changing news and what have you. On the plane going home, Rabbi Singer pulled out a book from his pocket and was reading it, and when he was finished, I said, "What was that?" He said it was the daily portion of Talmud. Well, I didn't know there was a daily portion of Talmud, and I said so, and I said, "How long does it take to read it?" He said, "Well, it's about 7.5 years. Wow. I said, "What did it say today?" He said, "Oh, you don't care." I said, "Come on, we're on an airplane. We have nothing else to do. Tell me what it said today." So he said, "Well, the Torah says that if an ox puts down 3 people, then you have to kill the ox. But it doesn't say what to do with the remnants of the ox, which after all has value, skin and meat." So the Talmud goes into it, and after 3 pages or so, you learn who gets what. I thought at first that was pretty arcane. Then it occurred to me that they only were looking for justice. And with that thought, justice, I said, "Oh boy, this is something, I got a pang of pride." And so I determined to study more.
Well, many people have talked about Judaism as a religion of laws. And and people live by those laws. Some live by all the laws, some live by some of the laws. But it definitely sets down a moral code and a legalistic code to live by.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think that your passion for Jewish causes and philanthropy stems from your lack of religion as a child?
No, I don't think so.
Not filling a void you were growing up?
I never felt a void. In fact, if it hadn't been for my experiences coming back from that trip to Russia, I might not have even become as passionate as I am about Judaism. But I always knew as I was a Jew, and I was always out there protecting other Jews.
Well, why? How did you get involved in getting the Jews out of Russia? That because you felt some kind of a solidarity with the people who were there?
That's partially.
Would it have been different? Would you have been just as committed if Catholics were the group that was discriminated against in Russia?
No. My 4 grandparents were all from Russia or from the Soviet Union. And I felt I owed them something to see if I could get Jews out of there, because I was so lucky that they had come to Canada. And so when Israel Singer said to me, "We're the only ones that have good relationships with the other satellite countries in the Warsaw Pact," I determined to go along and see if I could do something about it. And I did.
You also helped, you convinced Pope John Paul II that a Carmelite convent shouldn't be built near Auschwitz. Were these things, helping free Soviet Jews and that sort of thing, negotiations held on behalf of the World Jewish Congress, or did you just have personal connections with the Soviets and the Vatican?
No, it was because of the World Jewish Congress, and I built those relationships over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting when I was meeting with John Paul II about these nuns at Auschwitz, because you can almost tell when he's interested, because he's mostly, you know, he's old and sick, and he's mostly like this. And then when you say something that he...
Wait, this is not television.
You're leaning back, and he's sort of shrugging with his shoulder, his chin in his chest. Then when you say something that interests him, he puts his head up. Then you know you're saying something he hasn't heard before. And when I told him that Orthodox Jews, in fact most Jews, think that God had to turn his face away from Auschwitz or it could not have happened, then any religious symbol there is anathema to the Jews, no matter what it is, and whether it's a cross or a mug and David or a nunnery. So we can't have a good relationship with the Catholic Church until that's removed.
How did you convince the Soviets to let those Jews out? Because that was a closed society. People couldn't leave. I mean, writers couldn't leave unless they were vetted. Dancers were sometimes prevented from leaving because they were afraid that they might defect.
Well, over time, I built a relationship, and I went higher and higher and higher in the hierarchy until finally I was meeting quite constantly with Shevardnadze, who was then their foreign minister, but also was in charge of cults and other problems.
He's the head of Georgia.
Then he became head of Georgia, but before that he was the number. There was Gorbachev, and there were two. There was Yakovlev, and there was Shevardnadze. Yakovlev was in charge of everything domestic, in terms of the economy, etc. And Shevardnadze was in charge of minorities and other problems.
So this is fairly late in the history of the Soviet
Union.
You couldn't have done this when Brezhnev was in power.
I don't think so, no. I think that, in all honesty, though we talk about the nasty terms about Khrushchev, without Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin, none of this could have happened. But he opened the door for Gorbachev, and Gorbachev was much more reasonable, and the people around him were much more reasonable. But also what we also have to realize is that the Soviet Union was kind of falling apart economically at that point. And they thought that they needed MFN, Most Favored Nation treatment, in the United States desperately. And they figured that I had control of it. And so when I said that I would make a plea to the Congress of the United States not to do it, they were very, very pleased with me. And over time, they decided that they would do good things for the Jews, hopefully that America would be very kind to them economically.
And for a time, it all seemed to work out.
It did work out.
Before Vladimir Putin came to power, but that's a whole other story.
Well, Vladimir Putin is not, at this point, done anything nasty to the Jews. He's just nasty to people who have money and have things he wants. We have the return of the Tsar in Vladimir Putin.
My guest is Edgar M. Bronfman, who's written a book called Hope Not Fear with the help of Beth Zasloff. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Edgar M. Bronfman, his latest book, Hope Not Fear, written with the help of Beth Zasloff, is published by St. Martin's Press. And you've written a number of books.
Yes, I have.
So you've done all this other stuff. You're working as a kind of an international diplomat. And you also write books?
Well, yes.
Is it it's a way of getting the message out, or is it just that you like to write?
Well, I think the first three were done because everybody liked to write. I think this one was done to get the message out and because I like to write.
In 1988, you got Swiss banks to own up to their role in World War II and pay more than $1 billion in restitution to Holocaust victims. That was way after the fact. How were you able to pull that one off? You didn't have Gorbachev there to help you.
No. This was kind of a bit of timing. There was nothing really all that exciting going on in the rest of the world, and we managed to catch the world's imagination with this one and just kept pushing it. And, of course, we had tremendous help from Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Stu Eisenstadt in the administration. And, you know, again, we just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. Actually, I think the most amazing look I ever saw on anybody's face was Paul Volcker's. Paul Volcker had a vision that all bankers were honest, real, decent people. And when he suddenly discovered that the banks were lying to him, his face just looked out, took this amazed look on his face.
Weren't you kind of surprised that they were able to pull it off for so long, just deny all those years? Well, I mean, the same argument was being made from 1945 on through 1988.
Well, you know what they did? They managed to pay people off. Somebody was coming and say, we want to know about this, and they say, here, we're going to give you $10 million, $5 million, whatever it was, and they'd go away. When I got there, they made me an offer, too. And I said, I didn't come here to discuss money. I came here to discuss procedure. And that kind of shocked them, because that's not what they were used to. And the sum they offered me was 32 million Swiss francs, which I guess was around $26, $27 million. But I didn't even pay attention to it. I simply told them what I really wanted to do. And then they realized, then I whipped out a letter that I had from Yitzhak Rabin, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, saying that I was representing the Israeli survivors as well as the diaspora survivors. Then they knew that they had met their match.
And it wound up costing them $1 billion.
Billion and a half.
Which they had had to use for all those years.
Yes.
And denying, in some cases, people their savings simply because they didn't have a bank book because it had been destroyed in the Holocaust.
That's absolutely true.
Let's talk a bit about Seagram's. You were there from 1951 until when?
Well, until we sold it, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But I was chief executive officer until 95 when I retired.
Were you responsible also for giving New York one of its greatest architectural treasures?
Well, in a sense, but I think my sister was much more to do with that than I did. She was the one that picked Mies van der Rohe and did the coordination of all the building. I was just simply the president of the company, but the American company. My father, of course, was very much alive, and she had to fight him fiercely, but she won.
I'm sure that at the beginning that looked like a very, very daring thing to do. Now it just seems like one of the great classic buildings of modernist architecture.
Well, the New York Times called it the building of the millennium, so I guess it got a huge critical award. And it's a beautiful building to work in. I still work there. I love it.
Did the spirits business change a lot over the years when you were involved?
Well,
it used to be hard liquor. Now there's a lot more wine drinking, isn't there?
Well, no, ratio really hasn't changed all that much. That's partly caused by taxation. It's also caused by lifestyle. And the spirits business itself has changed with the advent of vodka-type drinks, tequila, etc. So but everything changes. I mean, that's the most constant thing we have is change.
Do you think that you were destined to your family to be in the business because the word Bronfman means whiskey man or liquor man in Yiddish?
Well, there must have been some ancestor way back then who was in that business, because otherwise we wouldn't have gotten the name. But no, I don't think there's any destiny involved. My grandfather and my father got into the hotel business. And a hotel in Western Canada consisted of was a bar and a couple of rooms upstairs.
Mm.
And the bar was where the action was. And that's what he learned and what he was good at.
Around the time that America, this country, was going through Prohibition?
Well, just a little bit before that. He started to build the whiskey, the distillery in Montreal in 1924, and bought Seagram, the company, in 28. And I guess 28 was during the period of Prohibition. But Father clearly knew that Prohibition was going to come to an end. He felt it in his bones, I guess. And he built up a great deal of whiskey in Canada for the day when it did end.
Right across the border.
Right across the border.
You called one of your books The Third Act, Reinventing Yourself After Retirement. Did you have to reinvent yourself after you left Seagram?
No, I didn't reinvent myself, but I think that the most important line I put in that book was, it's not what you retire from, it's what you retire to. And I retired from Segev, and I went got really heavily involved in the World Jewish Congress and then in Hillel.
But you were already there, weren't you?
Well, yeah, but I got much more heavily involved in other Jewish things as well as that. So it was not a transformation, but at least I knew what I was retiring to. I was going to be very busy and very satisfied with the work I was doing.
Are you still the chairman of Hillel?
Yes, I am.
That's the world's largest Jewish campus organization.
That's right.
How has Jewish life changed on campuses in the past 20 years?
Well, getting back to the subject we were just talking about, some close to 50%, not quite 50%, of all the Jews who say they're Jews on campuses come from a one Jewish parent family. So that has changed enormously because Hillel originally was there for Orthodox kids where they could eat kosher meals and daven when the time came.
And if kids come from mixed marriages where the mother is the one who's not Jewish?
Either.
Because now I understand Hillel recently changed its rules to allow non-Jews to join. Are there a lot of non-Jews who want to join Hillel?
I wouldn't call it joining because that's not the right word. We don't have membership. What it is using the facilities and getting involved. And yeah, there's a lot of non-Jewish kids that get involved because they come with their friends.
You grew up in Canada. Did you plan to move to the United States?
Ever since I was 10 years old.
Canada is a pretty nice place.
Well, okay. I left Montreal. My parents took the four children down to New York in 1939, to see the World's Fair. And I looked around New York, and I loved its size, its anonymity, and its glamour, and I said, I'm going to live there. I fell in love with the city and when I was 10 years old, and I never fell out of love.
That was before Toronto became the surrogate of New York in all the movies.
Well, I was came from Montreal, not from Toronto. So, I mean...
Better food in Montreal.
Than New York?
Well, at that time, I suspect.
Oh, no. No, no. And at that time, there was no fresh this and no fresh that, and airplanes were bringing you this and that. You know. No, no. Food was... anyway, my mantra is that there are two places on Earth to live, New York and elsewhere. And I love New York.
Ed Graham Brofman is here. He's written a book called Hope, Not Fear, written with the help of Beth Zasloff and published by St. Martin's Press. And the philanthropy, when did you realize that that was something that would be important to you?
Well, I think I always knew that. My father was a great philanthropist. He was always leading every cause, Jewish cause and non-Jewish cause in Montreal. And indeed, he was president of the Canadian Jewish Congress for 18 years. And so I just was, you know, following an family example. That seemed to be the thing that I wanted to do the most.
We have seen any number of wealthy families resist becoming philanthropic, and then others. There are some that say, "Well, we're going to give away everything that we have because what good is the money if you don't use it for something that helps other people?" I mean, are you surprised by those there are some who are brought into philanthropy kicking and screaming, we've seen a few famous cases of that.
That always surprises me, but it takes all kinds to make a world. I've always I enjoy giving my money away intelligently, and I think it has to be done intelligently.
And what would intelligently mean?
Well, where is it going? How are they spending it? Are they doing any good with it? And if they're not, let's give it someplace else.
But would it mostly be Jewish-related causes?
In my case, yes, but not necessarily.
What about your siblings? Are they philanthropic as well?
My brother is very philanthropic, at least as philanthropic as I am, and my sister is too.
A listener wants to know your views about women in Judaism.
Well, I happen to be totally egalitarian. In fact, my staff sometimes call me a feminist because most of the people who work in our foundation are female. In Judaism, the Orthodox certainly do not treat women as well as they should.
Well, there is separation, but there is separation in most Middle Eastern religions.
Well, that may be, but Judaism in America is not a Middle Eastern religion. It's an American religion. It's apple pie. And I think that there are lots and lots of groups like Hadar, who will get together and pray. They do exactly the same prayer as the Orthodox do in their synagogue, except that they're egalitarian.
But when you say they're in America, there is this debate in any number of religious communities, and I would think that this applies to Muslims who want to wear headdresses and traditional garb, and people from the Greek Orthodox Church who dress just as they would have in the old country. How do we decide that this is an American brand of a religion as opposed to the brand that that was always in existence?
Well, there's some history behind the differences in Judaism. We do have Hasidim living in Israel who wear the Polish uniforms of the 18th century.
And we have Hasidim here who look like they just came over from the shtetl.
And that's the way they live. And whether the children still live that way or not, it's hard to tell. Both Reform Judaism was imported from Germany because it was just too difficult for people who really wanted to assimilate to live the style of the Jewish religion. So it was much easier to stay Jewish but live that the Sabbath was Sunday instead of Saturday, and they could eat anything they wanted to, etc. They brought that over here, and then when the big influx of Jews came from Eastern Europe, they thought that was much too easy, much too reformed, and they didn't like that. So they didn't want to go back to the old Orthodox, so that was too difficult. So they settled on conservative Judaism, which is sort of a mixture of both.
There are many people who are concerned about just how far away Reform Judaism has gotten from the mother religion. And then I've read people who are horrified about what happened in Germany when Hitler came to power and Jews said, but I'm a German. They didn't really think of themselves as Jews. Is that something that you think about when you do the kind of work that you're doing?
Well, it's never been a problem for me. I've always known I'm a Jew, and I was at first a Canadian, now an American, and I'm an American. And which comes first? I mean, it's like the story about the kid from Texas when he came up. He was in New York on Pearl Harbor Day, and he went to enlist, and they said, you know, kiddingly, what's going to happen if there's a war between Texas and the United States? Whose side are you on? He said, let's get this one over with first. So it's not a it's not an either-or situation with me. I'm Jewish, and I'm proud of it.
And you've started an organization to bring young people back into the fold. There's magazines, there are other things. How have you seen any success?
Oh, yes. It's mostly anecdotal. We don't really have figures yet. But I started a website called myjewishlearning.com, and I also have a place called the Curriculum Initiative, which tries to get at Jews who are in prep school. And they've been successful in terms of how many people they get involved. We get over 300,000 hits a month on myjewishlearning.com, and that will increase, I hope, substantially. And that's just it's a non-denominational portal where you can find out any question you want to find out about Judaism. I think that's the way the kids operate these days. Anything that's on the computer, they're happy with.
And you said that one of your concerns is that there are so many young people who have no idea about what their religion's all about.
Yes, that's a big concern. And, you know, we try to teach them. I mean, the best thing that's happened in 50 years or more is Birthright, where kids get a 10-day trip to Israel. They don't try to cram any religion down their throat. They just, they're in the Jewish homeland. They have Jewish Israeli soldiers on the bus with them, and they learn to appreciate the kind of society that there is in Israel.
Edgar Bronfman will be speaking with Charlie Rose at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8 o'clock. For more information about tickets and other things, you can check out our show page at WNYC.org. There also are two October events that he will be involved with. His book, Hope Not Fear, written with Beth Zasloff, is published by St. Martin's Press. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on this show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
On tomorrow's show, two writers who had to leave their homelands because of political and racial discrimination talk about the challenges of being an artist in exile. Also, Anne Royfe on how she coped when her husband died after 39 years of marriage. We celebrate the life and work of Leonard Bernstein with his brother Burton Bernstein and New York Philharmonic historian Barbara Hawes, plus a look at the past, present, and future of French cuisine in New York with Ruth Reichel and chef Andre Soltner. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Carolyn Silvera, Jen Poyant, and Leslie Dickstein. Dmitry Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening.